you've been told this session is going to be about pericardial diseases. This is kind of an interesting topic to present because it's very hard to just say, hey, this, you have pericardial disease. It really is kind of something you can do really quickly and say, this is how you treat it, and then you're done. But I think it's a good review topic because it's a disease that's oftentimes misdiagnosed because of the diversity of clinical signs that a lot of these animals will present with. You see a number of manifestations of this disease prior to getting to the fact that you're probably dealing with heart disease rather than something going on in the GI tract or in the liver. In most studies, pericardial diseases or pericardial effusions in dogs represent about 1 to 8% of the canine cardiac diseases, of all the canine cardiac diseases. And then pericardial disease is found in about 6% of cats, but most often when you see these cats, it's not really their primary presenting complaint. It's not the pericardial effusion or the result of pericardial effusion. It's usually some other underlying disease that causes them to have pericardial effusion. And oftentimes, you don't really need to treat the cats with pericardial effusion. You treat their underlying diseases to try to take care of that. This prevalence is probably underestimated from most textbooks because, once again, they rely upon a referral population. So we probably really miss a lot of these diseases, either from animals not being referred or being euthanized. So most of this data comes from tertiary facilities and not necessarily may not be a true representation of what you guys have seen in private practice. Just kind of as a review really quickly, the structures of the pericardium. The pericardium basically is a serofibrous sac. It contains I'm not sure if you can see this very well. It's not coming out on here too much. There's a pink line here that the fibrous tissue is the outer layer of this structure. And at the base of the heart, this actually combines into or melds into the great vessels, the aorta and the pulmonary arteries. And then at the apical portion of the heart, this actually forms the fibrous lesion, forms the sternopericardial ligament, which kind of anchors the heart in place in the thorax. And then you have this serous pericardium, which is basically a closed sac-like structure that the heart actually invaginates into. It contains the parietal pericardium, which is the outer portion of this structure here. And then the visceral pericardium, which is the yellow portion here on the inner layer, which basically becomes your epithelium of the heart, which is very much adhered to the heart, except for the areas where the vessels, like the coronary arteries, supply the heart at. You have a little bit of lack of adherence of that structure to the heart. And then you have nerves that run across the pericardial sac, some of which supply some innervation to the pericardium itself. The phrenic nerve, the recurrent laryngeal, and the vagus nerves all run through the pericardium at the base of the heart. So a lot of people say, well, this structure here is there. Nobody's ever really figured out what the significance of the pericardium really is. It's a lot of different theories, but nobody really knows. So the function of the pericardium, at least in theory, is that it protects the heart from extension of pleural or mediastinal diseases, especially infectious diseases. It prevents excessive cardiac distension, especially of the right side of the heart, which would result in regurgitation of the valves of the base and also result in an inefficient contraction of the heart. It also serves the purpose, as I said earlier, to anchor the heart within the thorax with that sternopericardial ligament there. And it also helps lubricate the surface of the heart. The big question is, with pericardial dysfunction, is we know that in most patients that you can function in the absence of the pericardium. So that's what confuses a lot of people as to what is the true function of this structure. Most patients, if you take the pericardium off, there won't be any adverse signs related to not having that structure around the heart. But we know that its presence in certain diseases will result in a clinical manifestation of what we see in our patients of decreased or impaired diastolic filling with eventual pericardial tamponade and in some cases constrictive pericarditis in some of our patients. So oftentimes our treatment will be simply just to remove the pericardium or open it up. So some things that I always end up talking with veterinarians about or our foreign vet population about is what types of things should I have noticed to recognize that this was a pericardial disease rather than something else going on. Well, most of the pathophysiology of this disease is related to signs of right-sided heart disease. And it's primarily because the right side, anytime you have fluid buildup in that pericardium, the right side being a very thin-walled structure, low-pressure structure, gives in pretty easily to that excessive outside fluid that's building up around it, that's constrained within that pericardial space. Which results in a triad of clinical signs that we typically discuss with our teach our students, basically a triad of pericardial diseases, including jugular venous distension, ascites, which is a sign or a pleural effusion in some cases, and weak femoral pulses. These three things together on a physical exam, pericardial effusion should be hopping up there on your list, especially when we get to talking about certain breeds and certain diseases and certain ages. And with everything, as with everything, timing is everything. Some of these signs may or may not be present, especially in acute phase of this disease, versus if you have chronic effusions. And we'll just tell you a little bit why this happens. So the onset of clinical signs of pericardial disease is dependent upon, one, the volume that's in the pericardial sac, and two, how fast that volume builds up in that pericardial space. If you look at this graph here, basically this is looking at volume over time and pressure on this loop here. And this is pressure within the pericardial space or within the right ventricle. What you see with rapid effusions is that this line here is the limit of pericardial stretch. And with rapid effusions, you hit that limit of pericardial stretch very easily and then reach the limit of and cause cardiac tamponade very early on in these patients with very acute effusions. This results in signs of, instead of that buildup of fluid, it results in low cardiac output signs because the heart now is not filling properly. And thus, if the right side of the heart doesn't fill properly, the left side won't also fill properly, and you get a decrease in cardiac output. This pressure is not only seen on the right side, it's also seen on the left side, but the signs that develop are primarily right-sided because the right side is such a flimsy structure compared to the left side. Whereas, if this effusion takes over time, if we have a slow effusion, what you see is the pericardial stretch will increase, and it takes a lot more volume over time to cause cardiac tamponade in these patients. So we get much higher on our volume loop compared to an acute effusion before we start to see critical tamponading of the heart structures in and of itself. So what happens with this acute pericardial effusion? Well, this is something we call florid tamponade, very acute effusion. This is a nice little study that shows what happens in patients with acute tamponade. They result in low cardiac output, weakness, collapse, decreased blood pressure, and pulsus paradoxus. And the reason is you can see what happens here. This study basically looked at the pericardial volume here on the bottom loop and then assessed stroke volume of the left ventricle, cardiac output, mean arterial pressure here at the top, heart rate, and pericardial pressures. And what you find is, as you get to a volume very rapidly over at about 100 mils in that pericardial space, you see the intrapericardial pressures get high, and when they reach about 10 millimeters of mercury, you start to see a significant decrease, or leveling out a decrease, past that of mean arterial pressure. Cardiac output drops off, as well as the ability of the left heart to have a decent stroke volume. And you see rapid right ventricular tamponade in these patients. And you also notice that the heart rate starts to jump up to try to compensate for that decreased cardiac output. So these patients may present to you very weak, very unstable as far as their cardiac output, blood pressures are low, and it may not appear that they have a bunch of fluid in these guys. So anytime you have a presenting complaint like this, especially an older breed dog that is at risk for something like hemangiosarcoma, pericardial diseases should start bumping up higher on your differential list as opposed to other things that could cause collapse or weakness like central nervous system problems. Oftentimes, it's related to pericardium, and we just miss it. Whereas with chronic effusions, the pericardial sac now has time to expand. And it expands its volume. And this is done by, in theory, nobody knows this for sure, certain, but what is thought to happen is that the pericardium, due to pressure, gets fibroblastic proliferation, and new connective tissue gets laid down as it stretches out. Secondary to that, as the stretch reaches its limit, and we start to develop pericardial tamponade, we see a myriad of clinical signs. One, pulsus paradoxus. And just to kind of give you an example of what that is, pulsus paradoxus basically is when you have a greater than 10 millimeter mercury drop in blood pressure as you inspire air. There's a normal decrease in cardiac output and normal decrease in blood pressure of about 3% when we take inspiration. And that's because the heart at that point in time preferentially fills, as the intrathoracic pressures decrease, we preferentially fill the right ventricle and the pulmonary veins with blood, and thus, because of that, we decrease the preload on the left side of the heart. Well, as we get to tamponading in these patients, that process is exacerbated. So we find that we have a further decrease in drop in blood pressure and decrease in drop in cardiac output, greater than that 3% that we see, which is usually about 10 millimeters of mercury when it looks at blood pressure with inspiration. And this is a very interesting finding. It's very prominent in these patients that you'll be palpating their femoral pulses, and all of a sudden the pulses will disappear. And then one of the things I always talk to students about is sometimes you need to pay attention to more than one thing when you're doing things. If you're feeling the pulses, you also need to be ausculting the heart. You also need to be assessing respirations, because pulses will change with respirations, and that is a telltale clinical sign of pericardial effusion before you've even done anything else if you have pulsus paradoxus. Now, that being said, pulsus paradoxus is probably only present by the time we get to see them in most of these studies in about 45% of cases. It's probably present very early on when you get to see it, but by the time we see it in a referral practice, we don't get that animal's past that point of having that process there. This is usually a very early sign of pericardial effusion in these patients. Then there's the compensatory response that occurs. The compensatory mechanisms include neurohumoral activation. I know you guys, a lot of you guys were here for Dr. Abbott's talk about heart failure, and probably he spoke about a number of things like the RAS system, sympathetic nervous system, endothelin. All of those things that cause sodium and water retention, like an antidiuretic hormone, are activated in pericardial disease patients with tamponade. There's another subset of the neurohumoral system that doesn't get activated in these diseases that actually gets activated in heart failure, called the natriuretic peptides. Have you guys heard of those? ANP and BNP. Those get activated in heart failure patients, but not in pericardial disease patients. And it's just because of the mechanism of activation and what their job is. Their job is to actually decrease volume and cause natriuresis, whereas that would actually hurt a patient with pericardial effusion, because the body senses a decreased cardiac output, so what it wants is more volume to help preload. So RAS system does that, aldosterone does that, endothelin system does that, antidiuretic hormone system, all those things help the body retain fluid. Okay. In the end, what that increased volume does is it actually increases our venous pressures. And down the line, that increases so much that basically what we get is effusion of that fluid out of the vasculature into abdominal spaces. And thus we get our pericardial effusion, our ascites in these patients. And you get the patient that comes in looking like this little poor fellow here with a big belly. Now, one other thing I always harp on, this is kind of my soapbox in school. And if you ask, I don't see any... Well, I see one ex-student in here. If you ask anybody about presenting a client like this, the first thing that you should look at in these patients to tell if it's heart failure is, anybody knows? Jugular pulses. Okay? If that animal doesn't have jugular venous distension and jugular pulsation, chances are that ascites, that belly, is not related to heart. Okay? And it's just because of what we said previously in that other slide, is that venous pressures are going to rise before you start to see ascites. And that's the whole venous system. It's the caudal cava, it's the cranial cava, and you're going to see it go up the neck to the jugular veins. And I would say about 98% of my cases that have right-sided heart failure have jugular venous distension. You just have to look for them and really assess them. Sometimes that requires, you know, doing a shave in the neck or putting alcohol on the neck so you can see those jugular veins distended in these patients. The other big thing in these guys, and I put this graph in here, this is kind of one of my heart failure slides, but I put this in here because one of the major mistakes I see veterinarians make with this disease is they put these dogs on Lasix because of the ascites. Well, Lasix does what to our patients? Here's the diuretics here. This volume, this is a pressure volume tracing here. This is end diastolic pressure, which you can replace with volume here. And this is cardiac output on this side here. Lasix basically takes us and brings us down to the left on this curve. So now we operate, even if we have a normal contracting heart, diuretics brings us to the part to the left at a lower preload or a lower diastolic pressure. Well, the problem in these patients is they already have a decreased preload and their cardiac output is already reduced. So Lasix actually only exacerbates that and actually can cause us to have signs now for a stable pericardial patient of decreased cardiac output, and now that patient becomes weak, anorectic, doesn't really want to eat, doesn't really want to do things. So this is one of the biggest things I tell people anytime I talk about pericardial disease, avoid Lasix in these dogs. There's a whole big old question if you talk to emergency critical care people, there's a whole split in these guys between whether you put these dogs on fluids or not to try to help preload. I tend to not do that with my chronic pericardial effusion patients. If they're not showing signs of low cardiac output, it's probably not a problem. If you remove the fluid, the ascites will reabsorb within 24 to 48 hours and their cardiac outputs will probably be normal. In my acute patients, it's probably a little bit more of a needy thing to put them on is fluids, expand that volume and increase preload in those guys. So those acute patients with low output signs, I tend to put them on fluids a lot sooner than I would a chronic pericardial patient. So what about etiologies and treatment of pericardial disease? It usually can be divided into congenital and acquired diseases. That's simple enough. So our congenital diseases include a congenital absence of the pericardium. This can be focal or complete. In those ones that you have more of a focal absence, the clinical signs may actually be related to entrapment or strangulation of cardiac structures within that focal opening of the pericardium, but otherwise these patients may not have any clinical signs. A very rare cause of congenital pericardial diseases. More common, what we see is the pericardial peritoneal diaphragmatic hernia, where we have an incomplete formation of the diaphragm and the pericardium, or incomplete separation of those, so that now you have a ability of abdominal components or peritoneal components to get entrapped within the remaining portions of the pericardium. And herniate in that area. This is very commonly seen in cats, especially Himalayans and Persians. They tend to be a little bit higher risk at developing this. And then for dogs, Weimaraners seem to be the most common breed of dog that we see this in. Oftentimes, these guys will also have concurrent sternal defects present in this disease. So what are clinical signs? Most of these are incidental findings, to be honest with you. Some of these patients will present from pain if organs get strangulated into the pericardial space, or vomiting if it's portion of the GI tract, like the stomach or the intestinal loops, may cause vomiting in these guys. Rarely, however, will they present with signs of impaired cardiac filling or function. So that's probably why most of these cases go unnoticed unless we happen to take a radiograph or they happen to come in with painful or vomiting. We don't know a lot of these animals have problems. However, there are some telltale things on physical exam, especially in dogs. Cats is a little bit harder. That might tell you that you have this disease present. One, the heart sounds will most likely be muffled on one side of the thorax or the other. The other thing is, in physical exams, and I always teach my students to do a palpation of the apical beat of the heartbeat on physical exam. I can tell you, I keep a count of this because I always tell students, I'm arrogant about this part. I've diagnosed 8 of these diseases just by palpating the heart alone, okay? And it's basically because the apical beat of the heart, in a lot of these cases, is shifted either very cranial or over to the right. Everybody remembers what the apical beat is? It's the strongest place where you feel the intensity of the heart on your fingertips. It should be in dogs between the left, fourth, and sixth intercostal space. If it's not there, something is causing that heart to be pushed or moved to the side. And if you palpate that thorax and palpate for that apical beat, you should feel in that area every time. Okay? If you go cranial and caudal from a normal patient with that, you'll feel that the heartbeat or the impulse upon your fingers is not as strong. So you go back, if you go in caudally, you don't feel that beat as strong anymore, go back up, that's your apical beat. If it's not in that area, something is pushing that heart where it shouldn't be. Okay? Cats is a little bit more difficult to do that because you have such a small heart and the heart feels like it's beating out of its chest anyway. And so it's really tough to say that. But some cats, you'll find that the axis, or you have to auscult the heart in a very weird location. Most cats, you have to auscult the heart right off the sternum. Okay? If you find that you're having to auscult the heart way up under the armpit just to hear the heartbeat, that may be a sign that something's pushing that heart out of place. And especially in younger cats, should jump up a little bit higher on your list as a differential. Some patients, you may get barbarygmus sounds or GI movement sounds if you listen long enough. And then other ones, like I said earlier, you may get a concurrent ventral midline defect in these patients, like a large hernia. If you do an ECG on these patients, you may see reduced size complexes, and you may see axis deviation of the ECG, meaning a normal ECG should have nice R waves. What you might find is that instead of having nice R waves on these patients, that you have nothing but S waves and no R waves present at all. Or you may get a strong left or right axis deviation in these patients. All of these things in cats and in Weimaraners should put this a little bit higher on your list. In general, thoracic radiographs, there may be generalized cardiac enlargement on the cardiac silhouette. You may see gas filled viscera within the cardiac silhouette also. And you may see reduced abdominal contents on the abdominal gastric axis. And I'm looking at this wondering if my talk is going to do what it's supposed to do, and it did. So here's a picture, a thoracic radiograph of a cat with PPDH. And what we see is these gas-filled structures. This cat had a lot of content within the pericardial space. Of course, this is a teaching file. They all don't look like this, so you may not get that. But oftentimes you see is these differing opacities in the pericardial space. The heart may not be this big, this rounded, but you may see differing opacities over the cardiac silhouette as a sign of that. The other thing you may notice in these patients is you notice how you lose the contour between the diaphragm and the heart here. You don't really get that completion of the diaphragm here. That may be your other sign that you have this disease present. Echocardiography shows increased pericardial contents within the pericardial space, and you also are able to visualize the pericardium, which oftentimes on echocardiography is actually very difficult to find the outline of the pericardium. So if you look at this patient here, here's your left ventricle and cross section down here, right ventricle wrapping around at the top, and whoa, that shouldn't be there, that's liver. That's only supposed to be there if your probe is a little bit further caudal. But also notice that you have this bright hyperechoic line that's wrapping all the way up to the liver here. This is your pericardium in this patient. Okay? So how do we manage these guys? They rarely cause clinical signs in most of these patients, but most of them do very well with surgical correction, especially if you get them before you have a lot of strangulation or problems in their intestinal content. Some people argue, well, should we even bother to do surgery if you find an older dog with PPDH and if he's doing fine all this time? I don't know the answer to that, to be honest with you. I can flip the coin on an older dog who's doing fine with this disease. The problem is he is at risk for still strangulating. It depends on what's in there. So should you correct them or not? And I leave that up to the surgeons to argue that. Okay, I don't do surgery on these guys. I don't try to correct them. I don't pretend to be a surgeon, so I let them argue that. My take on it is if he's at a higher risk for developing adverse effects then, and the surgery is pretty non-eventful, why not do the surgery on these guys? Younger animals, it's probably mostly indicated that they go to surgery to correct that so that they don't have any problems with developing strangulation or eventually developing clinical signs with this disease. So my recommendation, if I find younger animals with this, is that they always go to surgery. Older animals, I let the owners talk to the surgeons and let them hash that out. Acquired pericardial disease. Here's your poster child. If you have an older golden retriever coming into your clinic with ascites, look in the heart. Don't even bother looking anywhere else. These guys are at high risk. I don't know how many golden. I don't know why we're seeing so many of them. Maybe it's because of the popularity of the breed now. But this just seems to be the cases that we get an emergency call Friday night, 8 o'clock, 10-year-old golden retriever coming in. I'm not even worried about heart failure. I'm getting my stuff out to tap the pericardium. And it's just a very high incidence of disease in these guys. Acquired pericardial disease often results in complete tamponade. The clinical signs we talked about earlier, those triad of clinical signs, ascites, jugular venous distension, weak pulses. They also may have a history of exercise intolerance in these patients. Other common signs. GI signs are very common in these patients. I went back and looked, did a quick little search of our cases, and found that 27% of our cases presented with vomiting as a main clinical complaint in these patients. From the owner, not the fact that the belly was distended out to here, but the dog was vomiting. In a study, I think this was Chick Weiss's study from Penn. He looked at dogs with mangiosalk, and 35% of those presented with GI signs. So these cases may fool you into thinking that other things are going on, and in actuality, they're vomiting because they probably have a poor cardiac output, and all of a sudden their perfusion is bad, and they feel nauseous. Coughing is another common clinical complaint, and polydipsia is often very common. I think that was in about 15% of the cases at Purdue, the polydipsia that I saw. And then on physical exam, once again, muffled heart sounds, weak femoral pulses. You may have pulses paradoxes and jugular venous distension and abnormal pulsation of the jugular veins may be present in these guys. With pericardial tamponade, I always recommend that you get a nice baseline of blood work in these guys. CBC to help rule out any infectious causes. Chemistry profile so that you can assess blood flow, make sure kidney flow is nice and normal in these patients. And then a coagulation profile, because in acquired disease especially, you have that rare instance of that patient, probably around 1 to 2% of these cases can actually be related to coagulation abnormalities like rodenticide toxicity. When I was an intern at Tennessee, I actually had a case that this was the only presenting complaint here, was pericardial effusion and ascites, and it actually was a rodenticide toxicity case. So it's actually a very interesting presentation for that. Thoracic radiographs are a must. They show generalized cardiac enlargement of silhouette. You may also see distended caudal vena cava in these patients, and you may see pleural effusion in some of these guys. Now, not all of them will have the heart that looks big and rounded, depending on which phase you catch them in this cycle. And this dog, this heart is probably pretty rounded, but it's being obscured by the fact that he does have a little pleural effusion. I probably only see this in about 5 to 8% of our cases that they actually, in dogs, that they've actually developed pleural effusion. Most of them will just develop ascites as the only problem. But this big globoid heart is usually present in these guys. Some of them really just taking up completely the thoracic cavity. And that's why they may have the signs of respiratory distress along with it. More than from heart failure, it may be related to the fact that the heart is not allowing them to expand their chest along with the ascites pushing up on their diaphragm. They can't really expand their lungs very well, so they present panting or dyspneic in some cases. On ECG, you'll see reduced sizes of your ECG complexes, plus electrical alternans in some cases, especially when you have large amounts of effusion. Electrical alternans basically are when you have differential complexes or sizes in your ECG complexes, and this is why you get this, especially with these large effusions. This is because in the heart will cyclically swing within that pericardial space depending on respiratory phase, depending on heart cycle also. So as you see here, we get a nice little beating heart. Looks a little bit like Cookie Monster to me, but then you have your effusion up here. This dog, we actually pulled off about 700 mils of pericardial fluid. It's a big Newfie, actually. So that was a huge effusate. Other things, your echocardiogram. I always get the question, well, when I refer this case over, doc, should I have tapped it already, or should I just wait for you to do the echo, or what? That depends to me on clinical signs of that patient. If that patient's stable and can get to us, I would prefer to have some effusion on board, because what that allows me to see is some structures in the heart that you can't normally see on the echocardiogram because the lungs get in the way. You can get a very extensive look, especially of the right side of the heart and the right auricular appendage bouncing out right here, just a little bit on this view. There's another view that we look at to look at that. That we start to look for diseases like hemangiosarcoma. Well, it's very difficult to find that when you don't have that effusion present. Or what happens is you have a tap that is done, it's somewhat incomplete, and it leaks out into the pleural space. That actually makes it a lot harder to echo to have that pleural effusion than it does to have the pericardial effusion. So to me, if the animal is stable and you're not going to do the tap and you want us to find out what's going on, send him. If he's not stable, go ahead and tap him. We'll deal with that problem down the line. Most of the cases, you'll see diastolic collapse of the right atrium and or the right ventricle. As you see here, this case, this animal has just the right atrium collapsing down during diastole. You may also visualize a mass if present, and obviously the pericardial effusion. Clinical management for us, this is going to vary depending on who you read and who teaches you. But for us at Purdue, it varies slightly upon the disease process that's present. Obviously, pericardial syntesis is going to be important in these guys. But it also may be that we are a little bit more aggressive at partial pericardectomy or pericardotomy in our patients. So when we look at pericardial tamponade, we have several causes that we look at. Idiopathic, as we all say, we can't figure out what the world's going on. We're not smart enough to figure out what's going on. So, and that's a subclass of groups. Neoplastic effusions and infectious pericardial effusions are common. And then you have this other very uncommon group, but in small dogs, you should suspect left atrial tear, especially if this dog has a big history of mitral regurgitation. But idiopathic, as I said, is unknown what exactly causes this to happen in these patients. It is the second most common cause, representing, depending on which study you read, anywhere from 19 to 25% of the causes of acquired pericardial disease and pericardial tamponade. 50% of these guys will recur after the initial pericardial syntesis. And most of them will result in having a very hemorrhagic effusate in these patients. Here are, this is our standard method of performing pericardial syntesis, and it somewhat depends on who taught you again. Anybody here from Penn? They taught, what did they teach? They didn't care which side you go in, right? Exactly. But we were always taught to be scared to death of the left side of the heart. Penn graduates, they're taught to go on either side of them. And Jim Buchanan is there, and he's probably pretty much right. The real scare of going into the left side of the heart is the tear, a potential that you may tear the coronary artery. because it's all on the left side, primarily on the left side, whereas the right side, you're not going to hit it. Where some people are scared to tap into the myocardium. Well, if you're going to hit the heart on one side, the left side is probably the heart to hit. It's a thicker muscle on that side. You're not going to probably tear anything, and it heals itself pretty easily. I feel most comfortable going on the right side, so that's what I teach. It gives you a little bit bigger of a window to go in. But as far as the lung notch is concerned, the cardiac notch in the lung, so we put our patients in left lateral recumbency, and we go in the right side, about the fifth intercostal space. And I don't know if you can appreciate this here, this angulation that you have on the tip of the catheter, where it's actually angulating, kind of, it's not going straight in. You're actually taking an angle toward the opposite elbow or the opposite arm. So you're really not going straight in, straight down on these patients. A lot of people miss the heart or miss the pericardium because they angle straight down to go in to the pericardium at the costochondral junction. Well, you need to angle slightly cranial and slightly toward the left in order to hit that heart sac in a good spot. Okay? We tend to use a very big catheter, a 16-gauge over-the-needle catheter. And as you can see, we hook this up to IV tubing, and we have a three-way stopcock on the end, so we can basically squirt the hemorrhagic effusion out into the retainer without having to disconnect everything. It's always surprising to me that no matter how many times I teach this to students, they always get surprised that the fluid looks bloody. And they always get worried, and I can always tell them, oh, God, you hit the heart and scared them half to death. But this is the most common effusate that you're going to see in these guys. Rarely is it more, it's a little bit more serosanguineous, but most of the time it's more hemorrhagic looking to me. Obviously, you want to make sure it doesn't clot. But in acute cases of pericardial disease, if you're tapping it, you may find that it clots in some of those cases. An ECG hookup will help you to know if you've touched the heart. So I always have an ECG on these guys. Before we stick this big catheter in them, we give them a local infusion of lidocaine, and we do a little bit of nick in the skin so that our catheter can go in pretty easily with a 11 blade. And it's a fairly easy procedure to do in these patients, but a lot of people are fearful of going ahead and doing that from the damage that you can do. But if you take preventive care and you hook up an ECG and watch it, you'll know when you're hitting the heart on these patients, and you know when to back off. So about 50% of these guys will recur even after a second pericardial syntesis. So at that point in time, I tend to use pericardectomy or a balloon pericardotomy as an option. I have balloon pericardotomy highlighted because as a cardiologist, this is what I do. The pericardectomies, I send them to surgeons to go ahead and cut that and make a window. And there's a couple of different methods. You can open the thorax, or you can do, some of you may be doing this, thoracoscopic pericardectomies. Any of you guys are doing those or know of any clinics that are doing those? Those are probably becoming much more common place to perform, and you get a nice big window created. The problem with it is that just like with pericardotomy, you can't, if you're trying to get a sample of the tumors, you can't, or trying to resect part of the tumors, you can't really do it very well with that procedure. So I know one of our surgeons, she's working on trying to be able to do this and also be able to get closer to especially heart-based tumors to resect those, but run into a lot of frustration with that. And this is just kind of an example of what we do. I hope this works. I don't know if it will or not. Owners that can't afford to have a surgery done, most of the time, and Purdue is pretty cheap when I tell people cost, but most of our surgeons, when they perform surgery in the thorax, the quote is about $2,500 to $3,000, just for opening a thorax. This procedure can be done fairly cheaply by, it's basically just like doing a pericardial tap, except for we put an introducer catheter into the thorax. We go a little bit further cranial and aim caudally so that we can have the maximal area where the pericardium is away from the thoracic wall. We then insert a wire through that into the pericardial space, that wire that you're seeing wrapping around here. And then we insert a balloon, a large balloon dilation catheter across the pericardial space. We have a nice waist here, and then we just stretch that waist open to create a pericardotomy in that patient. We've done this very successfully in a number of patients, and it does cause a relief of the clinical signs, and we haven't had any, knock on wood, recurrence of clinical signs of pericardial effusion in these patients. The biggest problem is that either the tumor gets bigger or a pleural effusion happens in these guys, and it becomes too much for the owners to keep going back and forth to get the pleural effusion tapped off. I know one cardiologist who's looking at this, even after TAPS, after pericardial syntesis, persistent hepatic vein dilation as a prognostic indicator in these guys. And what their suggestion is that even after they remove the fluid, the hepatic vein should come down in size. The caudal cava should all, because the pressures in the venous system should all go down. Well, what he's seen is that in some animals that are going to refuse very rapidly or constantly refuse, is that the hepatic veins on ultrasound stay dilated in those patients. It's very intriguing, and it may be suggestive of some type of constrictive pericardial issues beyond that of what the fluid caused. It may have caused the pericardium to now become stiff and the pressures to stay high in the venous system in these patients, and tends to be a poor prognostic indicator as it pertains to re-effusion or increase in clinical signs in these patients. So that's something that you may want to keep an eye on down the line in these patients. It's something I know I'm going to start looking at just out of curiosity. Neoplastic effusions. Hemangiosarcoma is the most common one of these, representing about 33 to 61% of all pericardial effusions of the acquired form. In general, these guys, we always give them a poor prognosis. I should put question marks behind that because there's some question as to should we or shouldn't we. And to me, it depends on what your idea of prognosis is in these patients. If 6 months is not a poor prognosis, then it's, you know, owners will be very happy with that. I think most of my hemangiosarcomas are probably living that long as we can control the effusions. Usually with these guys, you can visualize an obvious mass on echocardiography, either in the right atrium or right auricular appendage, or in a right atrioventricular groove. Now, in this case, this was a case we did that not too long ago, actually, and one of the things you probably noticed is that there's not a lot of effusion here. This is your left atrium, left ventricle, right ventricle here. This is the right atrial mass. You notice how mixed echogenic it is. It's actually invading the right ventricular wall here, and on another view, it's actually extending outside of of the heart. And this was a case that we actually did a balloon pericardotomy in, and a dog lived another 8 months, 9 months actually, after we did the pericardotomy, even having this huge mass in here, until the mass actually caused a further obstruction of inflows, and that actually probably was caused the clinical sign in this patient rather than the pericardial effusion. So some of these guys can do very well. I'm not very high on what, especially right atrial mass, is doing those procedures, but this is an owner that really wanted to go for it because I was scared that these tumors, hemangiosarcomas, bleed out, and that way basically we're going to allow this effusion to go unrestricted and bleed into the pleural space without, and the animal is just going to bleed to death down the line. But he actually proved me wrong. I thought he was going to do that, but did well for a long period of time. So management of these cases is always somewhat controversial to some extent. I say, and this is one of the things we go back and forth with at Purdue, pericardial syntesis, if necessary, if there's an animal that has clinical signs associated with his disease, we tend to do pericardial syntesis. But we always warn the owners that these guys may bleed out within the next 24 hours pretty quickly, even after taking the fluid off. Part of the reasons that we think they stop bleeding to some extent is because of the intrapericardial pressure causing the pressures to increase on that mass to stop effusing into that space. And by removing the fluid, we allow that bleeding to occur again, at least in theory. In our feeble minds, at least that's what we think. But some of these patients actually prove us wrong, and we will do pericardial syntesis on them. And we have done, like I said, in that one case, that's the one hemangiosarc that I've done a balloon pericardotomy in, and it did very well. Survival data is very highly variable in these patients. It ranges anywhere from two days to 8 months. and the studies that you have. So, it's, you know, what can you tell an owner with that? Exactly. But the one study that's out there right now that's looking that has looked at treatments for these guys is from Chick Weiss from Penn, where he looked at pericardectomy and plus tumor resection alone versus pericardectomy plus tumor resection plus chemotherapy. And what he found with these dogs, at least in 8 of the dogs, that there was a median survival of 175 days compared to a median survival of 46 days in those 15 other dogs who didn't have chemotherapy added on to it. So chemotherapy seems to give us some benefit as far as once that tumor is resected and pericardium is removed. We do get some added benefit, so it may be worthwhile convincing the oncologist that, hey, why don't you give this dog some chemotherapy based on these studies that we're seeing. The problem with this disease is majority of these cases don't really have resectable tumors. The only ones that are really resectable are those that are in the right auricular appendage. The majority ones we see are unfortunately like the last ones where you had that huge mass that's invading a majority of the atrium, and you can't just take that out of there in most of these patients. And that's why we get that poor prognosis. And so I usually tell owners about 6 months time period. As opposed to heart-based tumors, those that are of neuroendothelial cell origin like chemodectomas or thyroid tumors, these, especially the chemodectomas, tend to be slow-growing tumors. They're about 10 times less common than hemangiosarc, but they still represent the third most common cause or the second most common cause of neoplastic effusions and the third most common cause of pericardial tamponade and acquired disease. Brachiocephalic breeds tend to be overrepresented in these patients. The theory behind why some of these guys get these tumors is because of the brachiocephalic syndrome decreases the oxygen supply to these cells and thus they go wild. So they're part of the cells going wild video, actually. These guys, I don't know if I believe that in that theory or not. They do develop a number of neuroendocrine type tumors, but I'm not sure if it's because of decreased oxygen supply to those areas. Generally, what you find is that you have a mass that's in a cranial aspect of the heart base. It's usually either on a caudal dorsal aspect of the left atrium in these patients. And what you see on an echocardiogram in these guys, in this case, ascending aorta. You see this large heart-based mass in these patients that surrounds the aorta and actually extends around to the left side here. This is your left atrium beating over here. Extends, surrounds this aorta very well, such that you can start highlighting the branches of the aorta in a thoracic on an echocardiogram, which you really can't do otherwise. These patients actually, to us, with surgical resection, which is sometimes possible in these guys, but even without the surgical resection, just pericardectomy or pericardotomy, they tend to do fairly well with this disease. Most of them have a median survival time of 730 days, as opposed to those who don't have this one of these procedures done, with a median survival of only about 42 days because of recurrence of effusion. This is one of these cases where I'm very strong on, hey, I'll tap it the first time, but your dog probably should have one of these procedures done to get the most out of life expectancy out of these patients. And so I really, push that these procedures should be done earlier in these guys rather than later. As opposed to mesotheliomas, these are somewhat uncommon cause of neoplastic effusions. Rarely do you see a discrete mass with these patients. It's diagnosed in about 5% of all pericardial effusion cases. Oftentimes, most of these patients will re-effuse in about 40 days with large amounts of pleural fluid with pericardectomy if it's been performed. And oftentimes, what you find is that in that 40 days, you take a radiograph and they have metastasized to the lungs or mets to the lungs in these guys. So it really doesn't have a good prognosis. I know they try intrathoracic cisplatin therapy in these guys, but they don't really do very well as far as expanding life expectancy. Lymphosarcoma, on the other hand, It's a very rare cause of pericardial effusion, but it tends to be a little bit more responsive to chemotherapy. And rarely do I find that I have to do pericardial synthesis even in those patients. It becomes sort of an incidental finding in some of these guys. Other things of interest that you may have heard about or read about with pericardial effusion, fluid analysis. People have assessed the pH, have done biochemical analysis on you name it, lactate, the bicarb, all of these things in pericardial effusions, and the latest have been the troponin eyes. And while these things are all good, they don't really do a good job at distinguishing one versus a neoplastic effusion versus idiopathic, because basically there's a huge overlap in some of the data between the dogs that have neoplastic disease and those that don't have it. So it doesn't really, to me, establish any kind of rule that says, hey, if you have this amount of one of these hormones or something in either pericardial or plasma, you're not going to find it. It doesn't really tell you if that's really neoplastic or not in these patients. Cytology, we always do cytology on our patients. Really rarely gives us information unless these patients have lymphoma or infectious causes of disease. You may have heard something about colchicin and NSAIDs and steroids. This is something that they've been using in people with chronic pericardial diseases. The colchicin has been showing some promise, but there's no data that suggests any of these things help our patients, especially the idiopathic effusion patients. It doesn't really seem to be doing us any good right now, at least in our patients. Infectious causes, some of the infectious causes may be from extension of pulmonary pleural abscesses, penetrating foreign bodies. One of the first cases I saw as a resident was actually a corn dog stick in a dog's pericardium that had penetrated the pericardium. And when we pulled the fluid off him, instead of having that hemorrhagic fluid, it looked like pure pus coming out of the pericardium. Believe it or not, surgery infused antibiotics in this patient. That dog did very well and is still alive 6 years later. So who knows? It's still doing well. Fungal is a rare cause of infectious pericarditis. Probably more often I see that. I've heard of that, not seen it, especially coccidioides in the western states. And then feline infectious peritonitis is a rare cause of pericarditis in cats. One of the most rare times things we see is a constrictive pericarditis. It's a rare cause of pericardial disease, and it may be that this is secondary to infectious process, but in most cases it's not panned out to have any kind of infectious relation to it, except in human medicines where we know viral diseases can cause pericarditis, constrictive pericarditis. This disease will trick you in that the clinical findings may not be that of the normal triad. You may have no pulsus paradoxus, no electrical alternans, thoracic radiographs, the cardiac silhouette may be normal. Echocardiography, what you may see is a thickened pericardium with no collapse of the cardiac chambers. And it's just that we have now the pericardium is basically just causing just complete diastolic dysfunction. That results in clinical signs. So clinical management would be either partial pericardectomy. Oftentimes, this pericardium now has almost a cartilaginous to bone consistency, and these oftentimes will require that the visceral pericardium be stripped away and something called epicardial stripping, and these patients don't do very well, unfortunately, with this disease process. And then the rare cause of left atrial tears, an uncommon cause of effusion in chronic valvular disease dogs. These animals will have signs of acute cardiac tamponade, so low cardiac output failure. Some people suggest doing surgery in these patients. Most surgeons have a fit if you suggest that to them because the atrium is so friable. Basically, when they try to suture it up, it just tears apart and rips apart through the suture. So what we suggest is strongly doing afterload reduction in these guys to try to reduce the amount of mitral regurgitation. What you see on echocardiogram is this, I don't know if you can really make this out, there's a little tear right there in the left atrium. And you see a blood clot that's surrounding the ventricle here, rather than a nice hypoechoic effusion. You see a blood clot that's starting on that wall and swings its way around the left ventricle. So in summary for you guys, pericardial disease is a little bit more common than we probably think it is. Don't get fooled by the fact that you may have a presenting complaint of vomiting and diarrhea in these patients. Avoid Lasix at all costs in these guys. Removing the fluid is the treatment that will remove the fluid from the abdomen. Lasix won't do that. If possible, get an echocardiogram so you can see what if there's masses in the heart, at the heart base, or in the right atrium prior to doing pericardiocentesis. But if you think that patient's at any risk, ignore that and just do the pericardiocentesis and treat the patient. Early pericardectomy or pericardotomies in certain cases may actually improve the life expectancy of these patients, so that it's not really a death sentence to have pericardial effusion in some of these guys. They may live a lot longer than we think they would. So at this time, I'll take any questions if you have any, and we'll look at our poster child of pericardial effusion. The question is, do I have a favorite sedation protocol? I probably favor opioids in most of my patients, and I will probably use something like butorphanol value. I avoid ACE in these guys because that will cause a little bit of increase in afterload, which the preload may not be up to par until you get the fluid off of there. So I tend to use something like butorphanol value combo. Any other questions? Thank you very much.